Michael, Mogadishu, what were we doing there? Mission.
So initially, it was actually a humanitarian relief operation.
The Somali What year was this?
In 92, we entered Somalia, just before Christmas of 92. And it was really just provide security for relief organizations. I was not personally involved at that point. And then over about a six-month period, the mission started to expand in scope and essentially became a manhunt. And that's when we got involved, because that's kind of one of the missions that we usually take on within the special operations world. So our rehearsals and our focus was on being able to go into the city and capture, as it turned out, a list of 50 individuals that the UN wanted apprehended.
What is the crew of, now this is your helicopter, right? Or an updated version of it?
It's not mine, but...
Well,
but I do have one, but it's not a Mike model.
But the Black Hawk, how many on the crew? And
typically in the Army, it's a crew of four. It doesn't have to be. I mean, you can just fly with two pilots if you want to. But typically for tactical missions, a crew of four, two pilots, two crew chiefs.
So what happened that day?
So it's the seventh mission that day you're referring to, I'm assuming, is Black Hawk Down, October 3rd, 93.
Right.
The mission that day is to go capture two top 10 personnel. We'd already captured the number two guy, and we'd captured 25 others. So we had 26 already in prison in a six-week period. So it had gone pretty well. We hadn't lost any people and hadn't lost any aircraft. But this particular day, we knew was going to be different. There was four things about it. One, worst part of town. If you put a pin on the map, the place you do not want to go in Mogadishu, that's where the mission was. Number two is daytime, so we can't use our night vision technology, and we can't really hide as well, obviously, in the dark. Number three, we've done it six times before, so they're starting to learn what our tactics are, and they're doing things to be more effective against that. And the last one is you can't land Blackhawks in the street. This part of the city, the streets are too narrow. So it's okay going in, because we can fast rope people in. Means you throw ropes out the side, and they slide down the ropes. Easy, in fact, it's probably better than landing. The issue comes with extraction. So we can't air land the Blackhawks, which means we've either got to get everybody off rooftops, which is not a good idea, because rooftop extraction, you've been on the target now for probably a half an hour, attracted a lot of attention. You come in and land on the roof. I mean, you think about it, it's kind of hard to articulate here, but, you know, picture a helicopter up over the top of that screen. Anybody in this whole area can shoot at it, whereas if you land it in here, you have the natural cover of the buildings around you. So if you want, in an urban environment, if you can air land, you want to do it. So we decided we're not going to extract with helicopters. We're going to extract with ground vehicles, which was the right answer. So we go in, the mission's going okay. Couple little things happened. We did have a Ranger fall from an aircraft, which, you know, to most people wouldn't be a little thing, but, you know, in the conduct of an operation like that, you know, you just fix the problem and move on. About 40 minutes in, we lose our first aircraft, and it was Super 6-1.
And how many aircraft were there?
There were over 20 on the mission.
Wow.
Yeah, and plus about four fixed-wing assets overhead. So, I mean, these are pretty complicated little missions. The first Black Hawk is shot down, and what they're doing is they're orbiting the target, not a 30-millimeter gun, but a gun with a high rate of fire, is 7.62, but we could shoot 4,000 rounds a minute with it. So much more firepower than the troops on the ground have on their own. It's why they love close air support and why they like helo support, because, you know, we can bring some real firepower to the fight. So he's in tight, circling the target, and gets shot down by an RPG. So a few other things happened. We had a search and rescue bird get shot down. It went in to try to help that down crew. They get hit by an RPG. So that's when I got called in to replace that first aircraft. So when you get called in to replace somebody who just got shot down, I mean, it's not going to be a good day. You know, and we knew that going in, but we also know the guys on the ground, they need the support. They're being pummeled and they're surrounded. And they're not going to get out of there if we don't help them suppress the enemy fire. So we roll in. We made it around about three times when we got hit by an RPG. And the RPG hit, that's the tail rotor on the back there. The nose, if you're not familiar with helicopters, is this pointy end over here on the left. The tail rotor keeps you from spinning. The RPG hit just underneath that big round gearbox casing that you can see right there. And it essentially blew everything off from that point up. The tail rotor left the aircraft completely, which in a Black Hawk is not a good thing. We were at low altitude, low airspeed. spun violently. The only thing you can do in that situation is shut the engines off, which is not something you really want to do either. But you have to get control of the aircraft. So we did. Ray Frank, my co-pilot, actually did it because a Blackhawk, if you get up close enough to see, the engine control levers are up overhead. They're not on the controls. So I'm flying. He's getting the engines off. And somewhere during that process, we hit the ground. And the only thing I'm trying to do is keep from flipping upside down, which I was able to do somehow. And we hit on the gear, which is the only reason I'm still here. And you mentioned, you know, dust off pilots from Vietnam. Not only, you know, did they set the culture for Army aviation, them and you know, all Hilo pilots in that war, but there's so many lessons learned from a technology perspective that if you parked a Huey here and you went side by side, you could talk about, you know, Blackhawk's got two engines. Blackhawk's got redundant flight controls. It's got redundant electrical systems, hydraulic systems. It's got self-sealing fuel lines. All of that stuff came out of lessons learned from Vietnam, things that, you know, would have saved lives had they been in place then that are in these airframes today, part of why I'm here. And it all works exactly as advertised.
So when you hit, how many? There were four of you on board at the time?
Yes.
So when you hit, who was injured? Anyone?
Oh, we were all injured very bad, yeah. I broke my, you know, even though those landing gear will strut or attenuate the crash, and the seat does the same thing. It has shock absorbers on it. We hit so hard that my right femur actually snapped off on the seat, just the pure G-forces of the impact. And then my vertebrae were crushed in my spine. Not the discs, but the actual bones themselves smashed into each other, and one compressed 30%, so the compression fracture is. So I had pretty serious injuries, and then obviously was unconscious for probably 5 minutes.
How quickly were you surrounded?
Well, onesie twosie Somalis started coming in right away, but two Delta Force commandos, Randy Shugart and Gary Gordon, were overhead, and they saw that something had to be done or we're going to be lost, and they volunteered to go in. And I don't think you can ever fully appreciate the significance of that act. You're looking down. I often ask myself, if I was in their shoes, would I have done that? You know, it's hard to, you don't know, there's no way to know. But they did, and not only did they volunteer, but they were told no initially. And then finally, one of them got on the radio directly to the command center and said, if you don't let us go in, these guys are gone. And they were given permission, they dropped off, and they came up alongside.
How did they get down?
Super 6-2, another Blackhawk, got as close as they could, and Gary and Randy maneuvered on the ground to finally get to our
side. Did they rope down? Or?
I think they jumped. I think they were able to get down to about 8 feet, and they jumped out.
Right. Now, they came to your protection, right?
Right.
And what happened then?
So they arrived on the side of the aircraft, and I knew them. So I'm thinking, somehow, there's a rescue force here. This is over. Not knowing, it's just two guys, and that's the next reinforcements don't get there for 8 hours. So we were on our own for the long haul. Didn't know it. So I'm optimistic at this point. But we fought the enemy off for, I'd say, maybe 15 minutes. Gary Gordon goes down first. Randy then comes back around, and I think at that point, it's just me and Randy. I don't think anybody else is left. I've shot all my ammunition. He gives me Gary's weapon. He grabs the crew chief's weapons from the aircraft and goes back around, makes his last stand. They estimate, you know, there's hundreds of Somalis here, so it's a matter of seconds before he just can't hold them all off. So he's killed, and then they overrun the site. Initially, pretty certain they're going to kill me because they're all out of control, angry and violent, and there's nothing you can do. I mean, you can't run, you can't hide, got no ammunition left. So I basically accepted my fate. So they descended on me and started to beat me to death. I mean, they broke my nose, my cheekbone, my eye socket. They were ripping all my gear off. And I had been to survival school. It's one thing, another lesson learned from Vietnam. We didn't historically send Army aviators or ground force to survival school prior to deploying to combat. But post-Vietnam, all of our special forces, of which I technically was qualified as, went to survival school. So I went to survival school where they teach you as much as they can what you're supposed to do in these situations. And they basically tell you, you know, make the best of it. Don't make it any worse than it already is. So I essentially did my best to just roll with the punches and not antagonize them anymore. They realized I had value as a prisoner, stopped the madness, fired shots in the air, got control of the mob, and brought me into captivity.
And what happened in captivity?
Well, it's no picnic either. You know, they teach us in survival school, it doesn't matter how hungry, tired, thirsty you are, evasion is way better than captivity. And it is, but captivity is better than death, I guess. So I was shot in captivity on the next day. They didn't care about my injuries. They were throwing me around no litter, nothing, just throwing me in cars. My femur went out the backside of my leg at some point in that process. They did a video interrogation, which most people recognize when they see it, aired on international television. But over time, doing some of the things they taught me in survival school, they began to be more, I don't want to say kind, but not as hostile. And it got to the point where I don't think, even if their orders were to kill me in the event of a rescue attempt, I'm not sure they would have, because they just kind of got to know me, you know, and developed almost a relationship with me, because, I mean, you spend 11 days with somebody 24/7, I guess they become human to you if they weren't in the beginning.
To what extent do you think they were already in the process of negotiating or trying to take advantage of the fact that you were captured?
Well, I don't really think they had a plan. It didn't seem like they had a plan initially. It seemed somewhat chaotic. And then when they made the video and it aired, obviously everybody knew that I was in captivity. But then the president sent the former ambassador, a gentleman named Robert Oakley, who the Somalis really...
President of the United States.
The president of the U.S. sent Robert Oakley to Somalia. And the Somalis really liked Robert Oakley. I've always said, if we had 1,000 Robert Oakleys out there in the world, we wouldn't have half the trouble we have, because he was a great statesman. He was a straight shooter. They trusted him, and he met with them, and he said, you got two choices. And I heard him tell this story to me more than once. He said, I told him, you can keep him in captivity, or you can let him go. If you keep him, sooner or later, we're going to figure out where he is, and we're going to come rescue him. And when we do, we're coming with everything we got. And there was AC-130s and fighters and carrier battle group all had been brought in to put this bonfire out now. And he had credibility, so when he said that, the Somalis said, I think the best course of action is let him go. And within 48 hours, they let me go. And I don't know if we're going to circle back, but Randy Shugart and Gary Gordon were posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor, and I just want to make sure that gets into the conversation.
Right. Yeah.